This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The conversation over the possible impeachment of Donald Trump has been talked about basically from the moment he took office. House Democrats introduced articles of impeachment last year during his first year as president. Previously on this program, our friend Jeffrey Rosen, the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, explained how the founding fathers designed impeachment.
The key provision is in Article 2, Section 4. But it says, the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And then there are two other relevant sections. Article 1, Section 2 says the House of Representatives shall have the sole power of impeachment. And Article 1, Section 3 says that the Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachment. And then it goes on to say that when the president of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall provide, and no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of two-thirds of the members present.
Now, that definition of treason, bribery, or high crime, other crimes and misdemeanors is really where scholars start to disagree. Does the president have to have committed a criminal act? Or does the Constitution allow for a more open definition of, say, treason? How did the framers see impeachment actually working? Here's what Jeffrey Rosen told us about past impeachments.
By talking about high crimes and misdemeanors, the framers gave as quintessential examples treason and bribery. So it didn't have to be a technical crime, but offenses against the United States could be tried. And for previous presidential impeachments, we've seen focus not on technical questions of low-level crimes, but in the case of Andrew Johnson, of subverting the will of Congress by firing the Secretary of War despite a congressional act to the contrary. In the case of President Clinton, the claim that he had impeded an investigation by lying to Congress. So instead of making the president immune or focusing on narrow criminal wrongdoing, the framers instead set out a broad standard for the House and Senate to interpret that prohibits executive and presidential wrongdoing.
Critics of President Trump have brought up the Russia investigation or the Trump Organization's business dealings as reasons to impeach, and they've drawn parallels to President Clinton's impeachment proceedings. But Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz disagrees. The lifelong Democrat broke ranks, wrote a book detailing his argument. It's called The Case Against Impeaching Trump, and he joins us now to discuss it. Professor Alan Dershowitz, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much. I'm a big fan of this program, and I really appreciate the opportunity to make my controversial case to your wonderful audience.
Oh, well, I'm glad that you like the program. I wonder if perhaps, well, thank you for that. I wonder if perhaps that might be a worthwhile place to start, because there are some fans of ours who have expressed some rather strong thoughts about the nature of this conversation. A number of listeners, including Aaron, tweeted, "I cannot believe you are giving airtime to Alan Dershowitz." KS in Lebanon, Ohio wrote, "It does not affect me personally when Mr. Dershowitz defends murderers and Wall Street criminals. However, the actions of the president do impact my health, civil rights, and my ability to fall asleep at night. President Trump threatens democracy itself. I am shocked that Mr. Dershowitz cannot understand why people are upset with him." Before we dive into your argument, just to get this out the way, for people who are mad that we even booked you, what would you say to them?
Well, many people are mad about what I'm saying, and they don't want to hear my point of view. On Martha's Vineyard, for example, when I was invited by the Film Society to speak, people said they would cut off contributions. Look, in America, we talk about our differences. I've defended people I've disagreed with since I was in college. I was a very, very strong anti-communist. But when Brooklyn College started firing communist professors or alleged communist professors, I spoke up on their behalf. And people said I was complicit with communism. Communists, if they took over the country, would destroy all civil liberties. When I defended the rights of Nazis to march through Skokie, people said I was complicit with Nazism, and so forth and so on. I defended Bill Clinton against charges of impeachment, and if Hillary Clinton had been elected president, I would have written exactly the same book with a different title. In fact, to make the point, my publisher actually produced an alternative cover for the book called The Case Against Impeaching Hillary Clinton. And the content would have been almost identical, because I have for 50 years, as a civil libertarian and a liberal, taken the view that criminal statutes should be construed narrowly, that we shouldn't allow criminalization of political differences and stretching of statutes. And when I read the Constitution, I read it very, very differently from the way people who I enormously admire, Jeffrey Rosen, Larry Tribe, our guest today, Professor Lichtman, I read the Constitution as requiring an actual crime. Now, it's a disputed proposition, and I want to have a debate about this. Mm-hmm. I want to begin a debate. But the idea that people don't want to listen to me because the person who is affected today happens to be somebody they voted against. I voted against him, too. I'm against almost all of his policies. I oppose them on immigration, on separation of families, on gun control, on health care, on taxation,
right.
on even breastfeeding. My God, the other day, the United States government took a view that we should discourage breastfeeding.
We talked about that on this program, yeah.
Right. I can imagine no president with whom I have disagreed more fundamentally and worked harder to see his opponent elected. So I'm not a Trump supporter or facilitator or somebody who is in any way an accessory to what he's doing. I'm a supporter of his civil liberties, your civil liberties, my civil liberties. If the American Civil Liberties Union were more involved in speaking up on these issues instead of earning an enormous amount of money by going after Trump, which is understandable, they should be going after his policies, I wouldn't have had to speak up, but somebody has to make the civil liberties case for narrow construction of criminal statutes and impeachment criteria. And I made that case in the book, and I'm happy to make that case here, and I'm happy to take critical questions. But I don't want people to say, let's not give anybody a forum, whether it be on college campuses for conservative speakers.
Remember,
I grew up during McCarthyism when it was the left that was denied a platform, and I fought to make sure that the left was heard, and I'm going to fight to make sure that all points of view are listened to.
I should note that we did speak to the president of the ACLU, Susan Herman, on this program not too long ago about the ACLU's current advocacy. If you want to hear that program, you'll find it on our website, the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter a.org. And we welcome your questions about the case for or against impeachment. We'll be debating it through the hour. What are your thoughts about impeaching this or any president? And for that matter, where is the Constitution a little fuzzy for you? Are there aspects of the case on either side that you think might make sense, but you could use a little more clarity? Now's a good time to get those questions answered. So email us, 1a at wamu.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1a. So Professor Dershowitz, I hear one part of your argument in terms of just the political animus against Donald Trump. The other part of the argument that to me seemed the most thorny, or at least that you go into a fair amount of detail explaining, is this aspect of committing a crime. As we said, the Constitution says impeachment deals with treason, bribery, and other crimes and misdemeanors.
High crimes
and misdemeanors. Elaborate on that a little bit. Is that like the strongest piece of your argument, the biggest piece in terms of why the president cannot currently be impeached?
It's the central thesis of my book. The framers thought about various approaches to impeachment. The British approach, which talked about malfunction in office and doing a bad job, and Hamilton and Madison, and the framers rejected that approach. They said they didn't want a parliamentary system where the parliament can determine how long the president serves. They wanted strict criteria before an impeachment and removal can be carried out. And so they made it both a legal process and a political process. And my argument is that conviction of a crime by the Senate is a necessary but not sufficient condition for impeachment. It has to be, by the way, not an ordinary crime. It has to be a high crime. And even if a president has committed a high crime, the Senate, of course, and the House have discretion. That's the political aspect of it. But there's nothing political about whether or not there has to be a crime committed. The language of the Constitution is very clear. It specifies two particular crimes, treason, which is defined in the Constitution with particularity, and bribery, which was a common crime. Everybody knew what it meant at the time of the framing. And then it uses terms or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, Blackstone, who was regarded as the authority on a law at the time, said that misdemeanor was a genre of crime. And indeed, I point out in my book, even at the time there was such a thing, it sounds absurd to the modern ear, as a capital misdemeanor, something that resulted in the death penalty.
Right.
Remember, too, that we didn't have prisons at the time of the framing. So the punishments for crimes generally were fairly extreme, either execution or banishment or some kind of warning, but you didn't have 10 years, 15 years in prison. But the framers knew what they meant when they specified bribery, treason, other high crimes and misdemeanors. And I don't think you should be expanding the words of the Constitution when you engage in so dramatic an act as trying to remove an elected president of the United States. So I argue, as a civil libertarian and as a liberal, for a narrow construction of the impeachment criteria, just the way I always, as a criminal defense lawyer, use the concept of lenity to argue for narrow construction of criminal statutes.
Reasonable people
could disagree.
We should also be clear about this, just for those who are a little fuzzy on the process. In terms of impeachment, the House brings the accusation, the Senate judges the accusation. Treason also has a very specific definition in the U.S. Code. The U.S. Code says, whoever, owing allegiance to the United States, levies war against them or adheres to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort within the United States or elsewhere, is guilty of treason and shall suffer death or shall be imprisoned not less than 5 years, etc.
There's an additional fact, too. And under the Constitution, it requires two witnesses to the same overt act or a confession in open court.
I do want to dig deeper into your case, Professor Dershowitz, as we continue discussing your book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump. We will bring in another professor to bring a contrasting argument, and we'll get to some of your questions and thoughts as well. What do you think about this case for impeachment, and what are your questions about what the Constitution does and does not say? We'll get to that in just a minute. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing whether there is or is not a case to be made for impeaching President Trump with Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz. He's the author of the new book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump. We'd love to hear from you, too. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. CPT 6th grade tweets, I hate Trump and everything he stands for, but I also believe in due process and do not support impeachment at this time. Impeaching Trump now would perpetuate the dangerous belief that a president can be impeached just because many people do not like him or her. Mm-hmm. Triangle Man tweeted, not only is Trump pretty clearly involved in conspiracy with Russia to hack U.S. citizens and government offices during the election, but every single day he violates both, yes, two emoluments clauses in the Constitution. We'll talk more about Russia and about the emoluments clause in just a moment. And Macondo tweeted, no American is above the law, any law. In fact, our elected officials should be held to a higher standard. Plenty of legal arguments there to discuss, and we'd like to bring in one more voice to help us discuss it. Joining me here in studio is Alan Lichtman, a distinguished professor of history here at American University and the author of last year's book, The Case for Impeachment. American University owns WAMU Public Radio, which produces 1A. Professor Lichtman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
Since the book came out, has your argument about impeachment evolved at all, particularly whatever you believe is the one strongest part of that argument?
Oh, my argument has evolved a great deal. I think based on what is known only in the public record, there was at least a strong case for obstruction of justice against Donald Trump as there was against Bill Clinton. And every Republican virtually in the House voted an article of obstruction against Bill Clinton. And it's not just that he has used his authority for corrupt purposes. It's also the ways in which he went beyond his authority, like dictating a lying statement about the June 2016 meeting for Donald Trump Jr., a witness in a criminal case. I also think, while I will defend to the death Professor Dershowitz's right to his opinion, I fundamentally disagree with the idea that impeachment requires only a technical violation of a criminal statute, which, by the way, changed dramatically over time. It was only recently that we had the federal criminal laws against federal corruption and campaign finance violations. The founders made crystal clear that impeachment was not limited to technical crimes, but encompassed crimes against the nation against society.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Alexander Hamilton said, impeachment will proceed from the misconduct of public men, or in other words, the abuse or violation of some public trust, and they relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to the society. James Madison said that he was very worried about the power vested in the presidency in a single man who, if he became corrupted, that might be fatal to the republic, and that's why we must provide in the Constitution for the regular punishment of the executive when his misconduct should deserve it.
I wonder though,
one more point. Mm-hmm. I will also quote a distinguished legal scholar from 1986 who made quite plain that impeachment includes lawlessness, a crime, but also involves much more than that. This scholar said, impeachment should be reserved for extraordinary cases of lawlessness, but also for extraordinary cases of corruption or tyranny. Who was that distinguished person? It was Alan Dershowitz himself. Mm-hmm.
Although I wonder, Professor Lichtman, if you're at all persuaded by what Professor Dershowitz is trying to convey, if I'm hearing him correctly, about the nature of the crime that has to be committed for impeachment to proceed from the House, through the House, to the Senate. I mean, the founders did describe high crimes and misdemeanors.
Absolutely.
The bar should be high, and this idea of impeaching a president for maladministration, for just being a crappy president, is something the founders rejected. If you don't like the president, vote him out next time.
I completely agree with that, and I say explicitly on page 233 of the case for impeachment that we should not consider impeaching a president because we disagree with his policies or values. I'm 71 years old. I go back to Eisenhower. I have fundamentally disagreed with many presidents, but never before considered the possibility of impeachment. And in the case for impeachment, I talk about what are indeed high crimes, possible conspiracy against the United States by making deals with Russia to rig our elections, serious violations of the campaign finance laws. Now, I'm not saying we should impeach the president now or we shouldn't. Again, I will quote a distinguished legal scholar who said, before you consider impeachment one way or another, you need to hear evidence. You need to make credibility determinations. We haven't heard the evidence yet from Robert Mueller. We've got to wait. And indeed, it is quite possible that Mr. Mueller will come up with serious high crimes and misdemeanors that are directed against the nation and our society.
Before I let Professor Dershowitz respond, I want to point out two areas where I hear the two of you saying very similar things. I'm hearing both of you say that impeachment is not a toy. This is a very serious arm of government that should be taken very seriously, and that impeachment should not be used for political trifling purposes just because you don't like the guy. There has
Absolutely.
To be a higher bar applied to impeachment. I want to be clear, even though there are disagreements, I'm hearing both of you say that and some of our listeners very clearly. Professor Dershowitz, let me give you a chance to respond to Professor Lichtman before we keep going with some of our audience's questions.
First of all, Professor Lichtman's book is absolutely brilliant. I recommend that everybody read the two of our books together and
Indeed.
Come to the conclusion. And, you know, the quotes he makes from Hamilton and Madison are the same quotes I have in my book. I just interpret them differently. I think both of them were saying that in addition to there being a technical crime, there also has to be corruption of government. There has to be efforts by the president to undermine authority. So I do think we need both. That is, we need a crime, but a specific crime that demonstrates that the president has acted in a way that fits the definition of Hamilton and Madison. So I think that Hamilton and Madison were narrowing the criteria for impeachment rather than broadening the criteria for impeachment. But I want to put out one question for all of your listeners. I want to ask you to look into your own hearts and answer the question honestly. Would you be making the same arguments you're now making if Hillary Clinton had been elected president and if the Republicans were trying to impeach her or prosecute her and were looking to the emails and looking to other kinds of things, which Republicans, many of them genuinely believe, constitute high crimes and misdemeanors? I can tell you honestly, not only would I be making the same arguments, I have made the same arguments when Bill Clinton was impeached. I always ask myself, do I pass the shoe on the other foot test? I wrote a book about it when I wrote a book railing against Bush versus Gore and how the Supreme Court did not pass the shoe on the other foot test. If it had been Gore versus Bush, five or four or three of the justices who constituted the majority would have voted the other way. What I'm very afraid of is that people are influenced by who the president is in making decisions about what the Constitution says. And that's a very, very dangerous phenomenon. So I want to continue the debate with Professor Lichtman, with Professor Tribe, with Professor Cass Sunstein. We have a reasonable area of debate. But what's shocking is that people want to cut off my side of the debate because they're so angry, and understandably, at President Trump. They're so anxious to get him removed that they're prepared to redefine the Constitution. Look, I agree with Professor Lichtman that the Republicans acted terribly during the Clinton impeachment, and I was opposed to it. And, of course, all of you have talked about the Johnson impeachment. That was one of the worst abuses of constitutionalism in American history. He was not charged with a high crime and misdemeanor, treason, or bribery. He was charged with something that turns out he did correctly, firing the secretary. The Supreme Court ultimately said that was a proper use. The only president who's been properly subject to impeachment was President Nixon. He committed high crimes and misdemeanors while in office. He committed real obstruction of justice by tampering with witnesses, by paying hush money, by telling associates to lie to the FBI, by destroying evidence. But he didn't commit a crime by firing the special prosecutor. It was a horrible, horrible thing to do. Archie Cox was a close friend of mine. Horrible thing to do. It would be horrible if the current president fired Mueller or fired Rosenstein. But none of that would be a crime. I'm a criminal lawyer. I've been doing this for 53 years. I don't want to see obstruction of justice expanded accordion-like to fit a predetermined target.
And I just want to make sure we're clear, Professor Dershowitz. When you say that that would not be a crime, you're talking about it in terms of the executive powers of the president, that he has the power to hire and fire people who fall under the executive branch.
The president has the authority under Article 2 to fire and pardon. In my view, as a criminal law expert, the actus reus of a crime, remember you need both actus reus, a criminal act, and mens rea, a criminal state of mind. The actus reus for a crime can never be a constitutionally authorized act like pardoning. President George Bush, the first, pardoned Caspar Weinberger and five other people for the purpose, the corrupt purpose of making sure they didn't point the finger of accusation at him. No one suggested impeachment because people liked President Bush. And yet that was exactly the same as in functionality as what President Trump has done. So we have to make sure we all pass the shoe on the other foot test, or as John Rawls would say, you know, the test that says you make decisions about rights without knowing who you are, without knowing what impact it's going to have and on whom. All I'm calling for is neutral principles of civil liberties equally applicable to all.
Before I get back to Professor Lichtman and give him a chance to jump back in, I hear you in terms of Hillary Clinton and particularly the emails surrounding her time in the State Department, having a private server, the whole Benghazi thing. Like, I get that. I wonder, though, about the acts themselves. I mean, we did have this comment from Triangle Man who mentioned Russia and who mentioned the Emoluments Clause. Right. And I wonder if you would feel the same way about Hillary Clinton if she owned a hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue and bought it from the General Services Administration, or if her son-in-law had taken a meeting with Russians who claimed to have damaging information on Donald Trump. I mean, is it about Hillary Clinton? If Hillary Clinton had done what Donald Trump has done and is accused of having done, would you feel the same about it?
I would, and I'll tell you why. As a criminal lawyer, the first place I look to decide whether something's a crime is the criminal code, or previous to 1815, the common law of crime. And it's simply not a crime to violate the Emoluments Clause, even if President Trump did it. It would be wrong. It would be bad. But it wouldn't be a violation of the of a criminal statute. There has to be an actual criminal statute. Having a meeting with Russia, collusion with Russia, terrible, terrible thing to do if it happened. Not a crime. The only time collusion is a crime in the federal law is when business people collude to violate the antitrust law. So we have to start with criminal statutes before we determine whether something is a crime. A lot of these things should be crime. I'd love to revise the criminal statute to make collusion with a foreign government in aid of an election a crime. By the way, as you know, the United States has often colluded with foreign people to help determine the outcome of an election. There was an article that talked about, you know, dozens and dozens of cases where we've done that. It should probably be a crime, but it's not. I just want to make one more point.
Briefly,
about
and then
neutrality.
I got to get back to Professor
Just
Lichter.
One quick point. I was on a program with a man from Ceylon who defined himself as a hard left radical. And he started the program by thanking me for defending his mother at Brooklyn College. When I was a student, his mother was a communist. That's how far back I go in defending the rights of people who I abhor, despise, whose policy I despise. I grew up in a virulently anti-communist home. Stalin was the enemy of the Jewish people, the enemy of democracy, the enemy of America. But I stood up and defended communists. I defended Nazis. Mm-hmm. I defended the rights of everybody. And I'm not going to change my philosophy at 79 years old just because I voted against and the president and supported his opponent.
Well, let me give Professor Alan Lichtman a chance to jump in. Professor, you've been very patient. Go right ahead.
Yes. First of all, I'm kind of surprised that Professor Dershowitz, whose entire argument is based on this very narrow reading of texts, should put his own addition to the texts from Madison and Hamilton. They never said, in addition to a technical crime on the statute book, that impeachment proceeds from corruption, abuse of power, acts against the nation or society. They said that was the very essence of impeachment. And while Professor Dershowitz claims to have been consistent, he never responds to what he said in 1986, that impeachment not only encompasses lawlessness, but also corruption or tyranny.
Corruption, he also says,
Hold
on just one second, Professor Dershowitz. Well, sure. Let me let Professor Lichtman finish. Go ahead.
He also says, quite incorrectly, that in his book, if candidate Trump had called up Vladimir Putin and said, hey, Vlad, I want you to release all this dirt that you have on Hillary Clinton, and in return, I'll ease up on the sanctions, that wouldn't be a crime. First of all, whether it's a technical crime or not, that clearly is the kind of corrupt and tyrannical acts that the founders have talked about. Imagine if Franklin Roosevelt, at the beginning of 1940, had called up Adolf Hitler and said, hey, Adolf, I know you got a lot of dirt on all our politicians. I'll ease up on your invasion of Poland. I'll ease up on your human rights violations if you help me get reelected by releasing that dirt. I don't think anyone would think that wasn't an impeachable offense. Moreover, it is a crime directly under the campaign finance laws, which say, and I quote, it is unlawful for a foreign national to make directly or indirectly a contribution or donation of money or other thing of value, or to make an express or implied promise to make a contribution or donation in any election. And moreover, it is a crime for a person to solicit, accept, or receive such a contribution or donation. The stolen emails that the Russians released were of immense value, worth at least tens of millions of dollars to the Trump campaign. Many analysts believe those stolen emails turned the election. It certainly would be a direct violation of the explicit campaign finance laws, which were designed to prevent this kind of corruption, as well as a selling out of the United States to a foreign power. And again, to quote Hamilton, foreign influence, he said, is the Grecian horse to our republic.
Look, I agree with that whole analysis, except that it wouldn't be a crime to accept stolen emails from Russia. The New York Times
to solicit them, it would be.
It wouldn't be a crime to solicit or to use them. The New York Times solicited, the Washington Post solicited, and used stolen material from the Pentagon Papers, from Manning, from others. There is a First Amendment right to use material, verbal material. The campaign laws refer to money, things of that kind. They cannot constitutionally be construed to refer to information.
Pause on that right there. We got to pause for just a second. We got to pause right there. I want to pick this up when we come back, talk a little bit more about the case for impeachment and a few other legal questions we'd like to put to Professor Dershowitz before our time is up. Stay close. Before we get back to our debate, we would love your help with tomorrow's program about Wisconsin. That state has gone through a dramatic political change. In recent years, this progressive bastion has turned into a red state. Wisconsin was one of the states Donald Trump won to become president. This change was the result of a concerted effort by a number of conservative political groups and activists. If you are a Wisconsinite, how do you see this shift? How has it affected you? Are you better off for it? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Perhaps you're one of the voters who helped shift the state, such as voting for Donald Trump after you voted for Barack Obama. What led you to support this shift? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. You can also use our new app, 1A Vox Pop, to send us an audio file that's faster, easier, and clearer than a voicemail. You can download 1A Vox Pop, V-O-X-P-O-P, in the App Store, and we'll share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our debate between Professor Alan Dershowitz of Harvard and Professor Alan Lichtman of American University. We're going to get through a few more of your questions and thoughts about impeachment before we speak on a few other legal matters with Professor Dershowitz. Professor Lichtman, let me give you a chance to respond, and then I'd like to briefly knock through a few more questions before we got to let you go.
I'll be quick. Again, Professor Dershowitz is reading into the law something that isn't there. He said, well, the law really deals with donations of money and not information. The law specifically says donation of money or other thing of value. Information is the currency of political campaigns and is of immense...
Hold on, Professor Dershowitz. Let him finish.
And is of immense value. It also says you can't solicit, accept, or receive anything of value from a foreign national. His example of the New York Times is not applicable because... the law refers to candidates and party committees. It does not apply to the press. So he's giving us an apples and oranges kind of comparison. Also, his example of Donald Trump calling up Putin and asking for him to dish dirt on Hillary Clinton could easily be result in a charge of conspiracy against the United States, one of the charges against Manafort and Gates, and this would be a much more serious conspiracy, and could be construed as bribery. Here is a foreign adversary bribing a president, not with money, but something vastly more valuable than money, access to becoming the most powerful leader of the world.
Yeah, the nature of those crimes, Professor Dershowitz, I think has got some of our listeners a little bit quizzical. Dr. Chaos 42 tweeted, what is your definition of high crimes and misdemeanors? You seem to be playing loose with these definitions. I have to say, I understand where Professor Lichtman is coming from. The matter of the Pentagon Papers had to do with the First Amendment and prior restraint of news organizations who've acquired something they may or may not publish. Information from a foreign government about, say, Hillary Clinton, who was the nation's top diplomat, could potentially be a matter of national security. Those don't sound the same to me.
Well, the question I ask again is, if Hillary Clinton had been elected president and it was alleged that she had asked the Russians for dirt on Donald Trump and the Russians had provided dirt on Donald Trump and that helped her get elected, the ACLU would be in this case demanding that the charges be dropped because information is protected by the First Amendment. We know that Barack Obama tried to influence the Israeli election, sent some of his chief aides over there with information about Benjamin Netanyahu, who he was very anxious to see defeated for office. We've tried to influence elections repeatedly, and the idea that you can criminalize information gathering is so in violation of the First Amendment. My major point is this. You can stretch the law. You can come up with imaginative arguments. When I was a professor at Harvard, I would always ask a series of hypotheticals. And then I'd ask the students, how many crimes can you find? And they were brilliant at that. And then I would ask, use your judgment. How many would you actually charge? And that separated the great students from the not so great students. It's so easy to imagine crimes, to stretch the criminal law. But as civil libertarians, we fought against that for years.
Well, I, as an American, don't have a civil right, a civil liberty to information related to our national security. I have the right to information in the public public sphere, but information that could affect the security of this country, that's not the same, is it?
Well, it is a crime, and a crime that the ACLU was strongly opposed to under the espionage laws to try to make public national security information. Nobody, to my mind, has ever alleged that dirt on Hillary Clinton or dirt on Donald Trump would fit that criteria. And even if it did, it would be unconstitutional to prevent a candidate from using lawful means to obtain dirt on another person. Now, if President Trump or candidate Trump had said to the Russians, I want you to hack the Democratic National Committee, of course that would be a crime. But saying, I want you to give me the information you've already obtained, that is really parallel under the First Amendment to the New York Times. Look, let's remember I have two arguments here. Number one, you need a crime. Number two, so far I haven't seen a crime. You can agree with one and disagree with the other. And some people are doing that. You can say, yes, you need a crime. But what President Trump has done is a crime. That's a less important argument to my thesis than the central argument that you actually need a crime, and that Hamilton and Jefferson, and I read them properly and correctly, were arguing that in addition to having a crime, that's at least the way I read it. Professor Lichtman reads it differently. Reasonable people disagree. He's a historian. I'm a criminal lawyer. Historians read things differently than criminal lawyers do for purposes of applying criminal statute. But I think my reading is a correct one. That Hamilton, who himself committed crimes, but they were low crimes, when he paid extortion to hide his adultery, but he insisted that that not have been that was not paid by government money, because he understood the difference between a technical low crime of the kind Bill Clinton may have committed and a high crime which involves government funds or government issues. Look, these are debatable issues. I'm so appreciative of your program giving us an opportunity to have two people, both of whom are smart and have read history and have different views on this. That's what America is about. Let's debate this issue, but let's debate it with the shoe on the other foot test foremost in mind, not targeting one particular individual and changing our arguments. Now, I did say in 1986, the way I was quoted, I hadn't done the research at that point. I hadn't looked at everything. That was my view at the time. Most academics took that view. I've done the research now. I've concluded that that's not the correct view. And I've done the research after reading Professor Lichtman's excellent book and Professor Tribe's excellent book, and have concluded that they're wrong about their construction of the Constitution. But even if they're right, that a civil libertarian should be arguing for narrow constructions. Because today, it's Donald Trump's civil liberties. Tomorrow, it's Hillary Clinton's. The next day, it's Bernie Sanders. And the day after that, it's you and me.
I should note that a number of our listeners have pointed to the Russia investigation as crucial in this matter. And that may be part of the crux of it,
in terms of what
comes out from Robert Mueller. Josh in Denver tweeted, I'm cool with waiting for Mueller's investigation to decide if Trump committed a crime. However, if Mueller subpoenas Trump, he should have to sit for an interview. He shouldn't be above the law.
Well, nobody's above the law. Let me be very clear.
Well, hold on. I want to read this comment from Chris.
Sure.
Chris writes, I appreciate that impeachment is a serious offense and should be used sparingly. But how do we know if high crimes and misdemeanors have been committed if we don't follow through with investigation for something like the Russian interference in our election? Hillary's email investigation ran its course and was found to be not in violation of the law, but none of us know the full extent of what the Mueller investigation has found. So yes, everyone is acting on their own feelings now, but the investigation needs to continue. Then we can make a decision about impeachment. Let me let Professor Lichtman jump in. I know we got to say goodbye to you in just a second, Professor.
Yes.
So go ahead.
Let me jump in and say, first of all, with respect to the statements of the founders, it's not a matter of interpretation. Mr. Dershowitz, who is saying you've got to read things very narrowly, is putting things into those statements, saying in addition to a crime, when they actually never say any such thing. He's also resorting to the kind of what about defense. Well, what about if it had Hillary Clinton? What about if Barack Obama had done these? It's a terrible defense. In fact, I explicitly say quite the opposite. I said you should not be considering the impeachment of Donald Trump because you disagree with his policies or values or you don't like him. In fact, in my book, I have a whole chapter called The Way Out about how Donald Trump could avoid impeachment. What I have focused on is possible serious both technical crimes and crimes against society and the nation. I'm not saying they're proven yet, But I have saying, as you said, in 1998, you need to hear the evidence. You need to make credibility determinations. And we're waiting to hear the evidence from the special counsel. You cannot at this point, Professor Dershowitz, say you can't impeach Donald Trump. We don't know.
We have to move on to other matters, and I know I do want to talk about this a little bit further, but I think by way of moving on, Professor Dershowitz, to a few other things we'd like to talk to you about before we go, I would like to get to this tweet from Gary, who wrote, "You guys have to put this in perspective. Between now and January 20th, 2025, there will not be 67 senators willing to remove him from office. This impeachment argument is pointless. The only solution is voting." Alan Lichtman is a distinguished professor of history here at American University. His book is called The Case for Impeachment. Professor Lichtman, thanks for talking to us.
My great pleasure. Great speaking with you, Professor Dershowitz.
Thank you. And read Professor Lichtman's book and read mine and decide for yourself.
Wonderful.
Let's talk a little bit more, Professor Dershowitz, about a few other matters before our time with you is up. Kind of related to this conversation, you know, defending unpopular people, O.J. Simpson, Klaus von Bülow. One of our listeners, named Mike, had a question for you about some of the clients that you have been involved with or have advised. Here is the question that he left for us.
Considering that Mr. Dershowitz was involved with the O.J. Simpson trial, is there anything on his moral compass that will prevent him from taking any case?
Mike, thanks for the question. Professor?
It's a great question. It's my moral compass that requires me to take the most unpopular cases, the cases that other people won't want to take. I started my career by representing people from the Jewish Defense League who planted a bomb and caused the death of a young woman. Nobody would take the case. I've done 50% of my cases pro bono over the years. I've been attacked viciously by people on the right and the left for who I defended. And I'm going to continue to defend the most unpopular cases and causes. I have my own rules. I won't defend anybody who's involved in continuing crimes, people who are involved in the drug trade or terrorists or mafia people. I'm not going to help them go back to the business of doing crimes. And I won't represent fugitives, people who have escaped from justice. And I won't represent people who want me to engage in unethical or improper conduct. But beyond that, there's no crime that's so serious or no person that's so heinous that under our Constitution, he does not deserve a defense. And if I preach that, I have to practice it. So the answer is no. I would defend anybody as long as he fit into those several criteria.
Anybody that you regret defending or a case you maybe wish you hadn't gotten involved with in retrospect?
There are a few, but they're mostly on personal basis. Leona Helmsley was an incredibly difficult client, and I just didn't want to be identified with her, seen in public with her. But I was proud to represent her legal issues in front of the court and a few other people like that. But nobody who I ever, I mean, O.J. Simpson, I did my job, and the jury decided, and then another jury decided the other way in the civil case. Remember, our Constitution suggests that better for 10 guilty go free than for one innocent be wrongly convicted. And so I've sometimes helped one of those 10 guilty go free. But what I lose sleep over is when, God forbid, I ever lose a case on behalf of an innocent client. I came very close to losing two innocent people on death row and managed to win at the last minute, not in the Supreme Court, but back in the state of Arizona. And that was one of my finest moments. So I'm going to continue to represent people. And if occasionally it results in guilty people getting off, that's part of the system. But innocent people being convicted, that's not part of the system.
The Harvey Weinstein defense is also ramping up. You're contributing to that. Talk about your reasons for doing so.
Well, I was asked by my friend Ben Braffman, who is a brilliant lawyer who is defending Harvey Weinstein, to help him on the constitutional issues regarding getting emails, getting material that might be exculpatory. And I agreed to work on that and that issue. We won. We got the emails. And so that aspect of my involvement in the case is over. But again, I continue to be willing to help anybody. And the more despised, the more unpopular, the more unwilling people are to give them an opportunity to defend themselves, the more likely I will get involved in that case.
Before we let you go, I wonder how you view kind of the gradient over time of having made these civil liberties arguments. You know, our show 1A is named after the First Amendment.
Right.
And it seems like this right to free speech and to kind of speak your mind is evolving over time, particularly maybe with the advent of social media. It almost seems like people are less tolerant of the least among these or the unpopular characters, even like Harvey Weinstein, who may deserve a criminal defense. Before we let you go, have you seen a change over time in the way that we deal with the civil liberties of unpopular people?
Oh, yes. Dramatically. When I was in college, it was the right that was attacking people's civil liberties and denying people the right to speech. Today on college campuses, it's the hard left and many of the people who don't want to hear me speak who are saying, we know the truth with a capital T. There's no reason for having a marketplace of ideas. Speech that offends minorities? The ACLU shouldn't be protecting that. And the ACLU is actually reconsidering its priorities in terms of the First Amendment. You know, I have an original copy in my home of the Bill of Rights as it was first proposed to Congress. And the First Amendment was not the First Amendment. It was the Third Amendment. There were two amendments previous to that, which were rejected by the states. And today there are people, whether they're gun people who think the First Amendment should be the Second Amendment, or hard leftists and hard rightists who think that free speech is overrated. And since we know the truth, we really don't have to open the marketplace of ideas to offensive speech. I'm going to keep defending offensive speech and offensive people. And that's my job. And somebody has to do it. And if you don't agree with it, debate me. But don't try to silence me, because I will not be silenced.
Alan Dershowitz, professor emeritus at Harvard Law School. His new book is called The Case Against Impeaching Trump. Professor Dershowitz, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for talking to us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
Remember to check out our new app, 1A Vox Pop, an easy way to comment or question anything we're working on. Makes a great recording, clearer than a phone call. You'll find 1A Vox Pop in the App Store and online at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.